We move to our next segment here with Bill Fletcher Jr. and Leslie Kagan. We have them both on the line, and we're very happy to have them both here to talk about the 10th anniversary of the global protest in an effort to stop the Iraq War before it began. And just by way of introduction, Bill Fletcher Jr., an editorial board member and columnist with the online publication BlackCommentator.com, an immediate past president of Trans Africa Forum, a labor activist with the AFL-CIO for many years as well. Leslie Kagan, a lifelong activist who has organized protests and political action on issues ranging from opposition to the war in Vietnam to racism at home, from nuclear disarmament to the lesbian, gay, transgender struggle for equality. Leslie is both former director of United for Peace and Justice, one of the key organizers of many of the demonstrations, including the initial ones on the Iraq War, and the Pacifica Radio Network as well. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Glad to be on.
So it's amazing to reflect on the 10-year anniversary. It doesn't seem, I guess, to get older, go, wow, 10 years already, but... I was in New York City, and I was in that ocean of people pressed together, you know, block to block, close to the United Nations, and certainly an enormous experience of solidarity with people in New York, around the country, and around the world. I'm sure many of our listeners participated as well. And without me going on reflecting here, I'd like to maybe ask you, Leslie, to begin by talking about all the hard work you did organize that, but as well as Bill, of course, and many others. But maybe you could talk about the importance of that protest, despite the fact that it did not stop the war, which, of course, was the point of it. But, just give us your initial thoughts, what you were thinking as you sort of dawned on you. It's been 10 years since that mammoth protest.
Right. No, it has been amazing to think, first of all, to think about what's happened in the 10 years since. But that's another whole show. The effort that went into building that day, I was obviously most directly involved in the New York mobilization, but United for Peace and Justice was brand new. We had just formed as a national coalition primarily aimed at trying to stop the U.S. from going to war in Iraq. We had just formed in October, several months before. Bill and I were both very involved in the initial pulling together that coalition. And it wasn't really until the beginning of January 2003 that we focused in a very major way on the organizing of the demonstration. So it was really about 6 weeks, maybe 7 weeks, of nonstop 20-hour day, 8 days a week kind of focused energy, when what was clear right from the get-go was that this would be a truly global day of action. I don't think any of us knew how big it was going to be until the day happened and all the reports started coming in, but it was clear right from the get-go that this was not just about one country or one anti-war movement in one country. It was about a global outcry and demand that the U.S. not go to war. And that was something that I don't think any of us had ever experienced anything on that scale and to that degree. And that was extremely powerful and gave us some little bit of something to hold on to hope that maybe we could be strong enough to actually prevent this war from happening, even though we knew what we were up against. But there was some glimmer of hope and possibility, and that in and of itself is a powerful force.
Well, I want to get to your reflections as well, Bill, but I'll just run down some of the numbers. You know, it's hard to know the accuracy of these things 10 years later, but, the estimates of 500,000 to 1 million people came to New York City for that big protest close to the United Nations. 500,000 to 750,000 people in Hyde Park in London, 200,000 in Brandenburg Gate in Berlin, and hundreds of thousands more protested in Paris, Amsterdam, Brussels, Barcelona, Rome, Melbourne in Australia, Cape Town, South Africa, Johannesburg, Auckland, New Zealand, Seoul, Tokyo, and Manila. I mean, it was just enormous as Leslie said, you know, we didn't realize how big it was till we all got home and kind of read the papers, heard the media announcements about what had happened that day. But, Bill, what are your sort of reflections on the importance of that day?
Well, I guess the first thing is that it was the right thing to do. And even though we did not stop the war, which is a point I want to get to, that level of mobilization was a critical domestic and global statement. And I think you can say in all honesty that it sent ripple effects that we feel to this day, including the eventual election of Obama in 2008. So I think that it was very important. It was very, very exciting. And at the same time, I think that much of the anti-war movement didn't study its history enough, or study history of the United States, or for that matter, other countries, because the ability to stop a war from starting is it's very limited. When a ruling group is sufficiently united, they're prepared to pull the trigger. It's very easy for them to pull a trigger. And if you look back, whether it was the Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War, the Philippine-American War, World War I, there were significant anti-war movements. And what anti-war movements generally can do is to contribute to ending a war in conjunction with other factors. It's very hard to stop. So part of the problem was that we were elated after February 15th at the numbers that had turned out in the United States and elsewhere, but that was not enough to stop Bush and Cheney. And I think that what we have to come to grips with is that probably nothing short of bringing the country to a halt would have stopped the invasion. And, you know, I mean, having a wonderful, powerful demonstration on a Saturday is not the same as having a wonderful, powerful demonstration on a Wednesday, something that we learned during the Vietnam War.
Let me, if I could just jump in, Scott. I think one of the things that we have to remember when we think about that day, certainly in terms of the U.S., this was the first really major mobilization after the events of 9/11. This was a year and a half after 9/11, and certainly in New York City, dealing with the police and the mayor's office and all the various agencies, and in fact the federal government showed up also on this. We were up against tremendous pressures to not even have any demonstration. But what happened, I think, was again there was such strong anti-war sentiment around the world and around the country that, you know, that people weren't going to let the powers that be stop us from at least being out on the street. So yes, I totally agree with Bill that not only doing it on a weekday, but doing it, day in and day out, not just from month to month, but literally day after day after day, could have made a difference. But we were in a moment in this country where we had to break through the kind of shutting down of public protests that happened after 9/11. I think that was one of, actually, for the U.S., one of the big contributions that day made, is that we kind of reignited the notion of public protest and re-inspired people to be out on the street, not just on the issue of the war in Iraq, but on a host of other issues at the same time.
I had just read an article, as you might have seen and some of the listeners saw, Phyllis Bennis had written an article about how the effect of the major global protests affected some critical votes at the United Nations when it came time for countries around the world to sign on with the war that the Bush administration was stoking up or not. And it seems that, all those millions of people in the street at least affected some governments to pull back and say, maybe this is not something we should be part of.
Right, I think that was part of the hope that not so much that we alone here in the U.S. would be able to pressure Bush and Cheney and you know, all the forces that they had mustered to go to war, but that the global movement would, in some countries, hopefully in enough countries, put enough pressure on a variety of governments to say to the U.S. government, we're not going to cooperate with you. And perhaps that would slow them down.
Bill, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I wanted to actually say two things. One was just that slight modification on what Leslie said. The in January of 2003, there was a large march in Washington, D.C., and I think the estimates were about 250,000, which we and UFPJ helped to contribute to, but was organized by ANSWR. And I think that there was this growing sentiment that you started to feel, so that what happened in February did not pop out of nowhere, but the sort of growing anger with the Bush administration, represented by the emergence of basically four anti-war coalitions, the beginning of various kinds of demonstrations, and then bingo, we did this thing in February, and it was tremendous. And I think that what Phyllis had raised in those pieces, you're correct. It did, what that did was that it helped to push certain nations away from going with Bush and Cheney, and thereby making the Bush and Cheney invasion that much more blatant as a criminal act.
You know, with all we know now about the dishonesty and the trumped-up evidence that was used to convince the American people to support this war initially, it's amazing to me that with all that and the popular antipathy to the war at the start, that people in the Bush administration are still accorded all this credibility in speaking on foreign affairs issues in our corporate media. It's somehow an injustice that these folks are even consulted, you know, when it comes to current issues that they're not involved with, but they're the go-to folks to find out, you know, oh, what are the Republicans saying about our foreign policy currently? How do you think that history will judge the Iraq war and the Bush administration and the figures in that administration?
Well, I mean, we'll see how history judges. I do think that that hopefully history will hold them accountable. I think one of the problems that we've had is that, since the end of the Bush administration, with the election of Obama and a new administration coming in, that his administration has not held them accountable. By not holding them accountable, by not, investigating or, exposing the lies and in some instances, not just the lies, but criminal activities, the breaking of laws, by that administration, it has let them stand as credible figures so that the media and other folks go to them and use them, as you said, as spokespeople. So I think that is a problem. I do think that I also think it's not too late. I mean, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think the Obama administration is going to go after any of those folks. But I think it's a shame, because I think that's the way to set some of the history straight. And I wish it would happen.
Bill, any thoughts?
I think that the mainstream media and other parts of the establishment are deeply worried about the instability that emerged in the aftermath of Watergate. And they are absolutely worried about, if not an actual civil war, some sort of major destabilization that might take place were you to actually prosecute these criminals, which is, is what Leslie was saying. I mean, they need to be hunted down, indicted, prosecuted, and jailed for their criminal behavior. But to do that, it would mean shattering a certain kind of arrangement that exists within the ruling elite. And while the extreme right wing of the ruling elite is absolutely prepared to do that, the so-called moderates, the people like Obama, they're not prepared to do that. And the mainstream media, I think, is incredibly afraid to push the envelope on this. And I think we are literally still living in the aftermath of the waves that were produced by the destabilization of Watergate. And therefore, the only way it's going to happen is not simply holding up that these individuals were criminals and that this was an incredible violation of international law. It's not enough to put that in op-eds. It's really something that has to be integrated into a movement and into the platform of people that are running for office.
Well, thank you for that. Just to reintroduce you both to our audience here in Counterpoint tonight on WPKN, we're speaking with Bill Fletcher, Jr., editorial board member and columnist with the online publication BlackCommentator.com and a media past president of Trans Africa Forum, as well as Leslie Kagan, a lifelong activist whose history of organizing political protests and political action goes way back. And she is both the former director of United for Peace and Justice, as well as the Pacifica Radio Network. And I'd like to ask you both now, in terms of, in reflecting on the history of that enormous global protest 10 years ago to try to prevent the Iraq War, what lessons can we learn, should we learn now, about the effectiveness of global solidarity when it comes to economic issues that we're all these nations around the world have been going through in the Great Recession and the austerity measures and the anti-austerity protests that have been going on? There is a call to revive that kind of solidarity these days, and I'm wondering if you see signs that something like that could be developed and infrastructure put in place to make it happen.
Well, I hope so. it is very clear with every single day that we live that it is one planet that we share, and that economic policies, political decisions, cultural activities, all kinds of things that happen in one part of the world has an impact in another part of the world, and that we are all connected. And usually we're connected because of bad decisions made by people putting into place bad policies. What we need is to be connected, through some sort of network of organizations and movements of people who see a new vision for the world, who know that a new world is possible, another world is possible. That is not an easy task. It does require resources. It requires, obviously, people power. For all of the value of the internet and the social media and our ability to communicate that way, we also need to actually sit in a room together face to face. From time to time, solidarity, in person, is I think a lot stronger and gives you a lot more momentum than just the internet exchanges. That takes resources. I'm not saying it's impossible. I think we have to do it. I don't have the formula for how it's going to get done, but I think that I know there is a global interest in trying to move in that direction.
And I'll just mention before I get your reply to that, Bill, and we have seen with the Occupy Wall Street movement and the Indignado movement in Spain and other sort of spontaneous-seeming movements that did spread like wildfire. People were ready for it. And as you said, Leslie, infrastructure doesn't come cheap to put all that in place and make it even more effective. But, Bill, what are your thoughts?
I think when I'm thinking about the lessons, I go back to the first thing I said. It was the right thing to do. The second is that in building an anti-war movement, it's not mainly about building one or multiple anti-war coalitions or major demonstrations. It's that the movement really has to permeate society. And I think that one of the lessons from the anti-Vietnam War movement was that that's precisely what we did, that the movement was not one organization, and it wasn't one demonstration or even several, but it was something that permeated everything, including the military. And so I think that when one thinks about building such a thing, you have to take a long-term view and understand that there's no silver bullet. The ecstasy, for lack of a better term, that many of us felt after February 15th translated into despair for many folks when Bush simply went forward, invaded Iraq, and Iraq crumbled. And there were too many people that said, we failed, we tried, nothing can be done. And that's absolutely the wrong way to look at any social movement, but certainly an anti-war movement. So I think that it was that we made amazing accomplishments. I'm very proud of what happened with the United for Peace and Justice and its role. I think Leslie's a great leader, and we had some wonderful people that were involved, and that the broader movement needed to be one where we just had a longer-term vision and recognized the victories that we did accomplish.
Well said, both of you. I wanted to maybe leave off on some new news that Leslie can bring to us about a major, I think the largest demonstration yet on global warming issues in Washington, D.C. just yesterday, and how that really presents an opportunity for cross-border organizing in an issue that obviously calls for cross-border organizing in grassroots popular protest to get governments to do what they should do to address climate change. Leslie, maybe just, we don't have a lot of time here, but maybe you could give us a quick update and how you think this current movement against climate change or for, you know, responsible climate change policy can, you know, move us to international organizing.
Right. Well, talk about an issue that affects everybody. I mean, climate change is a global phenomenon. It was very clear yesterday. I honestly believe there were at least 50,000 people out in Washington, D.C. on a pretty cold day, especially when those winds were blowing. There was a significant presence of Canadians, especially Indigenous people, both from the United States and from Canada, because a lot of the focus, not the only issue, but a lot of the focus was on the Keystone Pipeline, which, of course, is supposed to run from Canada through, you know, right down the spine of the United States. So there, right away, is, you know, more than one country organizing. And the level of cooperation that we need to have between U.S. organizers and Canadian organizers on this is, you know, it's critical that happen. I know that 350.org, which is one of the groups that they and the Sierra Club really took the leadership on the call for yesterday's demonstration, but 350.org already has a global network of activists and organizers. I don't have it off the top of my head how many countries they're in, but they have a global network in place. So I think people understand that we need to, you know, we have a particular responsibility here in the United States, because so much of what our country does, our government, the private corporations, the military, etc., you know, sets the tone and the pace of the rest of the world. But we have to understand that we are part of a global community, and I think there is a potential, you know, on the climate change issue to strengthen that cross-border organizing. I also hope, though, that we don't, that we do learn the lesson of figuring out how to make the connections between issues, there's no time to go into it now, but global change is not an isolated phenomenon. It's related to wars for oil, for instance. We have to make those connections if we're going to be strong enough to make any policy difference.
Well, Bill, maybe I'll give you the last word here to just comment about climate change and how it provides some opportunities for international organizing that was evidenced 10 years ago on February 15th.
I think that that what we have to understand is that climate change, along with economic injustice and a whole set of other issues, need to be part of a platform of fighting for power. And in that, many of us, too many of us, are simply used to resisting the evils of the system, the attempts at war or whatever else, and that what we really have to think about is winning. And what will it take to win? What will it take to crush these evildoers? What will it take to actually implement, put into power and implement the kind of policies that people were demonstrating about the other day around climate change? That's what we need to be focusing on. Because, you can't keep fighting defensive battles without ultimately losing, no matter how strong you are.
Again, thank you both for being here tonight and reflecting on that important date, February 15th. Thanks for all the work you put into that, as well as all the work you've done your entire active lives on social justice and peace issues. And thankful that you could both join us tonight to reflect on February 15th. And we hope you'll can join us again to talk more about your future projects and organizing. So thank you both, Bill Fletcher Jr. And Leslie Kagan. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good
okay.
night.
Yes.
Good night, guys.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Night.
That's Bill Fletcher and Leslie Kagan talking about February 15th, 10 years ago, the big demonstrations all across the globe, 350 cities. It was an effort to head off the then threatened war against Iraq by the Bush administration.